Today's date is Friday, June 25th, 1993. My name is Lynn Olson. The following is an interview between myself and Dr. George Sanderlin, who is a retired professor of English from San Diego State University. He was here from 1955 until 1983. The interview is being recorded at his home in El Cajon on Singing Trails Drive. The interview is being conducted for the SDSU Emeritus Faculty Oral History Project, which is supported by a John and Jane Addams Humanities mini-grant. Let's make sure this tape recorder is running and picking up, and I see the needle moving, so I'll ask you the first question. I know that all your educational milestones are outlined for us already on paper, but would you tell me very briefly about what your educational background was before you came to San Diego State University?
Well, my high school was Central High School in Washington, D.C., and that was one of the four or five chief high schools. J. Edgar Hoover was the one graduate about whom they boast less, I guess, now than they used to. Another one was a famous singer, and I can't remember her name. She was a very, very fine singer. About 500. The graduating class was 200 or 300. Am I doing all right? My voice annoys me.
I think you're doing just fine. Well, let me turn it off and we'll...
I said, oh, you sound just like you always do. I said, that's terrible. But anyhow, we'll go to the Central High School in Washington. Let's see, I must have graduated in 1931 and had a scholarship to American University, also in Washington. About 300 students there then. I think they've grown quite a bit since then. I don't know what the enrollment is now. And that is where I met Oneida, whom I married, although she'd been living at the top of the hill all the time, but I paid no attention to girls up to that
point. Could you spell her name?
O-W. Her father was Owen, and she was supposed to be a little Owen, but she turned out to be the different sex, so she's Erzat Spanish Oneida. I-T-A added to O-W-E-N-I-T-A.
I didn't think it was Juanita. It sounded a little different.
Juanita. In fact, we have a book of hers that I'll give you afterwards, and a book of mine. So anyhow, American University, 31 to 35, and had a scholarship throughout there. Worked in the library part-time. Worked in the Library of Congress summers from the time I was 16 on. But I graduated there when I was, 16, because then I graduated I graduated when I was 20, so yes, I worked in the Library of Congress from age 16 on summers, and I graduated from AU when I was 20, and then I went to Johns Hopkins for graduate work. From 1935 to 38, and we could go straight for the PhD there, which I did, rather than stopping on an MA, and I got my PhD when I was 23 at Johns Hopkins, 1938, and so I guess that's it as far as the educational background.
Well, let me ask you then, when did you decide that you had a love of English? Did you know from a very early age, or
very
did you maybe
early,
pick this
I would
up
think,
when you were working
I
with the Library of Congress, perhaps?
Let's see, I think Oneida learned from my mother or whatnot. I wrote a short story when I was 9 or 10. I think it was a baseball story, because I did a lot of reading. I enjoyed the Baseball Joe books. That was a series. I enjoyed the young, it was a series about the Civil War. 8 books, series about the Revolutionary War. This was a man named Altshuler, and a writer of juvenile books. I wasn't thinking of writing junior books or juvenile books for young people then, but yes, I liked to read and I liked literature. So I guess I would say from high school on, I enjoyed Latin in high school, and then I did a lot of Latin on my own afterwards. So I guess... I decided I want to teach. Yes, I would say high school and college.
Your study of Latin, did you get very far in that, and did you find that Latin helped you in your teaching and your study of
Latin
English?
I think Latin helps. I think knowing any other language, and Latin is especially good because it's very regular, the grammars, the inflections, it's all pretty regular. It's easy to memorize. I won't take your time. I can recite any of the conjugations, declensions, or the syntax that you want, because I go over them every day.
Do you?
Yeah. I can do it in a very short time. I do the same for Spanish, which I learned later in connection with a writing project. But no, the Latin, I didn't have a great deal of Latin, and I had 3 years in high school, and then I decided that I wanted to be a medievalist, so I simply began to read, and then I taught Latin. I taught medieval Latin, a little special course, special studies at San Diego State for 5 or 6 years. One of the letters in that book about the thing is by a person who took that course from me. I had a little group of 3, 4, 5, or 6 people.
Uh-huh.
And I met them every week for a couple of hours, and there's some very good texts for medieval Latin, and so I taught that at that time. I also was in on Spanish exams by that time, by the time that I had worked on the project of translation from Spanish of the Historia de las Casas, and so they had me sit in on their MA Spanish exams, 4 questions on that field of Spanish 16th century history, which is what I wrote, what I use in some of my Explorer books and what I did the translations from.
Bartolomé de las Casas.
De las Casas.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I started to say C. And of course, that book's still going, thank heavens, to my surprise, but it was came out in the second edition a year ago. I'll show that to you. And
I'd like to take a look at it. You know, I did a little bit of background homework that mm-hmm. way by checking the pack mm-hmm. at the library to see which books we have of yours.
Yeah, okay.
And I didn't really pay attention to that one. I noticed a lot of others, many others, and I'll ask you about your publications later.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Very prolific writer, I must say.
Well, it was all, to me, it's sort of, it was part of teaching. And I've heard one other member of the department, Jerry Bumpus, I guess, who came in later for creative writing. Although actually they brought me in for that to begin with, but then I really wanted to do the medieval, and that's what I soon was doing. But Jerry Bumpus said what I've often said, that teaching writing, I want to be able to prove I can do it. Jerry is a novelist. I haven't read anything of his lately. I'm sure he's turning things out rapidly. So, to me, the teaching and the writing kind of went together.
Well, since you mentioned it, then I will ask you, the way that you were able to publish so many books and have so many articles published in professional journals and carry a full teaching load just amazes me, that you could do all that at the same time.
I got up at 4:30 in the morning.
Did you work many hours?
In the morning.
Did you?
Yeah. And I could write for about 3 hours then. And then I could have a class maybe at 10 o'clock. If I got to school, even fairly late, if I got to school by 9:30, late in the 70s, you could still get a parking place. Of course, you can't now. And so I could follow that schedule. And I didn't get up every morning at 4. And I got pretty tired. When I came home from teaching, I'd be pretty exhausted. I would sleep for about an hour.
Uh-huh.
But then I would often have tennis after that. It would just depend.
And then the tennis would revive you.
Yes.
For the rest of the afternoon and evening,
yeah.
So you could pick up where you left off, huh?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's great. Well, I really admire the way that you could do so much. You can produce so much.
I enjoyed everything I was doing. So.
Mm-hmm. Did you find then that, you said that the teaching and the writing go hand in hand. You used your research material for your writings and your coursework
yes,
as well.
Yes, it would. That's true. These mm-hmm. Explorer books, but after all, I was teaching the Renaissance, and the exploration discovery is part of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then my editor, Ferd Bonjo, wanted me to do some things in American history. Well, that didn't come so much into my teaching, but it was 18th century ideas and so forth and so on.
What was the editor's name again?
Ferd Bonjo. Last name is Monjo. That's Spanish for monk. Ferdinand Bonjo. And when the book Ferdinand the Bull came out, Ferd told us he had to have a fight at school every day. He was kidded about Ferdinand, the bullfighter, the
uh-huh.
bull who didn't want to fight.
And yes.
Mm-hmm. Which I have a copy of that in Latin by the wife of Moses Hadas, who was leading classical scholar at Columbia University for years. His wife wrote the way we have Winnie the Pooh in Latin, Winnie ille Pooh.
Yes, yes. Oh, I speaking of getting back onto the Latin aspect of it again, another little transcription that I did was with Gail Burnett.
Oh, yes, yes, Gail was great. She did a tremendous lecture. I unfortunately didn't get to it about a year ago, and she's in her mid-80s, I guess, now.
Yeah.
And she's had this group, I guess she still has them, kind of like my ego classes, I guess. This is a little informal group that she meets with for literature and reading
mm-hmm.
and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
She talks about the formation of that group, as a matter of fact,
really?
During her interview. And it's quite informative. It's very interesting. They just... this is not her group, but she said that they just celebrated the 10th anniversary of the Friends of Classics
mm-hmm.
in 92, and she was describing the big celebration that they had, and I guess the university officials, Day, and whoever else was there, had to get up and give some greetings or salutations in either Latin or Greek, which must have been quite a lot of fun.
Yes, until in the 30s, Harvard was still delivering part of their commencement address was in Latin. I remember Arden
really?
Havens at Huffman said, "Well, I was there this year, and I could understand most of it." He said, "I don't know just what aspect of the commencement, whatever, but anyhow, it was delivered in Latin."
Uh-huh.
And,
did you ever work with Gail Burnett?
Or did you just happen
to teach that class?
Yeah, no, I didn't. She taught the. She kept the Latin. She kept the Latin going here, or started it going, or nourished it for years
mm-hmm.
before we had the department that we now have,
right.
And that was just all her doing. I don't know whether she did that as an extra the way I did the medieval Latin. It may have been that part of the time it was an extra, maybe part of the time they gave her credit for teaching it, I don't know. But it was without Gail Burnett, I guess it wouldn't have been Latin for quite a few years here.
Yeah, I really can't tell that. I'm not real sure about that. I do know that she said that when she first came to the university, and I forget what year it was. They had Latin in the catalog,
oh, really?
But they didn't have anybody teaching it.
Didn't have anybody to teach it, so she kind of moved in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then Ted Warren came in and was very interested in teaching Greek.
Ted. Oh, yeah. Ted really got the thing in an organized basis and an accepted basis, but she kept it going before that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Ted came in some years later. I forget how many. Gail was before I came. I don't know how many years before I. There was a whole group right after World War II that was included Sidney Gulli and others.
Right.
And and then there was another group about the time I came.
You were possibly the second wave.
Might have been the second wave. I'm not sure. I know that Sidney Gulli and others coming at that time, probably perhaps Ernie Marchand and some of the others, and then let's see. Well, yes. Oh, chemistry, let's see, education, engineering, English.
Yeah, that's from the 54 Del Sudoeste Day.
54, let's see, Adams, Theobald, Kramer, Gail Burnett is here, Kennedy, second row, Claude Schell, so yes, I'm here, I didn't realize. Yes,
yeah,
so
you were there.
Oh yeah, and there's Sydney, I see him over to the right. Yeah,
Now, the... I guess officially, everything that I've seen in writing says that you officially started working at San Diego State in 55, but there you are in the 1954 yearbook. Would you maybe filling in
I
as
a lecturer.
Or?
I was a visiting lecturer taking
the
place of Mabel Trail. I don't see Mabel Trail here.
Mabel Trail?
Well, that's why I don't see her, because she was on leave. Trail. And I think her field was 19th century.
Oh. Okay, I've never heard that name before.
And they had, then I got back because, Juanita wanted me to, we wanted to get to California. Juanita grew up out here in Pasadena. Her father was a doctor. And I was getting a little tired of the winters by that time. Not so much the winters in Maine, the spring, the mud seasons, mud and snow in April and May, you get a little tired of it.
Yeah.
And I wanted to see what California was like, so she thought this would be perfect when I had the chance to come out. And then we did like it. And
when did you come out to California?
54, as the spring of 54.
It was 54.
As a visiting lecturer, that was my title was lecturer. I was paid what she was paid. So I was filling in for Mabel Trail, who was a full professor then. And so we did like it, and apparently they wanted me to come back, so they offered me the job. But I went back to Maine for the rest of 54 and the spring of 55, but they offered me the job in 55, and it came out
well,
fall of 55.
Tell me what the hiring and the interview process was. The reason why I asked that is because I know that in the earlier years it was very simple. It was just a matter of going in and meeting the president and saying, okay, you're hired. Was it still
right,
that way?
That's right. I believe Bob McCoy, who's coming, who has just come back out here, he was here, and I understand that's the way he got his job when he was discharged from the Navy or something. He just heard that there was an opening, walked in and said, I have an English degree, can you use me? And they said, sure, come on. So you'd have to confirm that with him, I don't know. But in my case, I did it with a letter, I guess. So Anita was very creative. She's the creative one. I sort of creature of routine, but I like to kind of figure out the routines and where I can get somewhere by working this on this language or that book or what have you. But Anita thought it would be a great idea to come out, so we sent letters to a number of institutions out here asking about summer work.
Uh-huh.
And we wrote the letter together, and she had some very good ideas, she does. And anyhow, Jack Adams liked the letter, so he said, come on, we can't give you a summer job, but how about coming for the spring semester? So that's the way I got that job, on the basis of a letter. And Jack Adams said, can you come out? And I think Sidney Gulick was in on the decision too, those two.
And Adams Sidney, and Gulick, huh?
Yeah. And then Sidney especially. Jack always says, oh, you owe it to Sidney when I talk about coming back. He says, Sidney said, we must have you or something.
Uh-huh.
So there wasn't any interview. I mean, I came out, and I do remember that Jim Tidwell, I didn't see him in the picture there. He was in that first group, Navy veteran. Died recently.
Yeah.
Not recently, right. A couple, two, 3 years ago.
Uh-huh.
Very good administrator. Everybody felt he should get to be the president of some one of the state colleges, and he was considered for several posts and never quite chosen. I think people felt that was kind of a disappointment, or maybe not a disappointment to him, but it was lost to the state colleges. He was a good administrator, a good scholar. One of the things they asked me to do when that spring semester when I was here was to talk to a group about writing. That's what they brought me out for, because they had a man in creative writing who had just been killed in an automobile accident. And so because of our freelance writing, Anita's in mine, we were writing, she could give you the figures. I remember that she just mentioned it to somebody else recently. She, I guess, sold a total of 1,700 articles, short stories, and so on.
Oh, Anita did?
Yes, and she says my total was 1,100.
Heavens to Betsy.
So we were doing that at Maine all the time, and that doubled our salary, which wasn't much of a salary to begin with, $1,600 a year.
Uh-huh.
But anyhow, we continued to double it. And so on the basis of my writing, as much as anything else, freelancing, I guess they, but they also, scholarship too, because they wanted me to take some advanced scholarly courses when I came out, which I did.
Uh-huh.
For that semester.
To teach them,
right.
Yeah.
So anyhow, as far as interviews, one thing they asked me to do was to talk to people, their majors who were interested in writing. And I remember Jim Tidwell came to that session. And so I kind of felt I was being checked out there. At that time, I wasn't sure that I wanted to come back. I didn't know whether they wanted me or not. But anyhow, I noticed that Jim attended it. And as far as if that was the purpose, that was the only interview that I had.
That might have been kind of a covert interview, as you say.
Yeah.
That could have been. That could have been.
Yeah.
Well, they obviously thought very highly of you.
Mike wants something here. I'll see what it wants. Come on in, Mike.
Hi.
Okay.
We were talking about the interview process and
As far as educational background, maybe I should say that in AU, I started out as a history major. And then I did become interested in literature. Then I thought literature was sort of more philosophical, more general, and I just liked it better.
Uh-huh.
But then it turned out a lot of my books are history, really.
They are.
But anyhow, I turned to English major there, and we had some very good teachers in the English department there and the art department. And so that I became interested. And then at
Johns
Hopkins,
American University, yes. Uh-huh.
Did the same thing. I decided I wanted to be a medievalist by that time. I was interested in Latin. But the medievalist there was Kemp Malone, who was a top man, but kind of hard to approach. And on the other hand, Art Havens, who was their 18th, 19th century man, was a bachelor, liked to do things with students. We had him to dinner a couple of times, and he went on a couple of walks with me. And he had PhD topics available. I was kind of scared of Bologna. I felt that to do it properly, I must know Old Norse, not only Latin, but Old Norse, Old French, of course, Old English we had to have. I had that all right. And so I kind of hesitated. But I wrote the thesis under Havens, but I did my seminar under Malone, and that got me over my fear, because when I went to the first meeting of the seminar, I was the only one there.
Oh, really?
Kent Malone said, well, he had this rather reserved manner. He said, well, you understand, Mr. Sanderlin, that in the seminar, the routine is that a member of the seminar gives a paper each time. So now we only have one member of the seminar, so this is the way we'll do it.
And you did it every time?
Well, after a while he relented, and he began to read his own papers. And the first paper I read, he tore apart. I felt pretty bad. The second paper, I spent the time, the whole week in Peabody Library, and I read that, and he said, well, I think we might publish this. So then he was one of the editors of Modern Language Notes. So then after that, we got along fine.
And did that paper appear in Modern Language Notes?
Oh, yes, it came out for my first publication.
But that was your first publication?
Yeah. Seminar paper.
And what do you remember?
We have it was on Beowulf. That was his field. The library has in the rare book section his edition of the Thorkelian transcripts of Beowulf. I used to take it into my medieval class every semester, just sign it out for the 1 hour to show them. Has a long list of sponsors headed by Winston Churchill. And this is a very important volume because Thorkelin was the Dane who made his own copy and had a scribe make another copy of the Beowulf manuscript. It's only a single manuscript, which is damaged by the fire, edges charred. Mm-hmm. And these transcripts were made in the 1780s, and they preserved readings that disappeared in the 19th century because of the charred state of the manuscript. Mm-hmm. So. And the library has one of the copies of this in the rare book section. So anyhow, those were kind of my interests. Plus, also I played in Johns Hopkins. I played on the graduate department basketball team, and we had a great offset triumph there because it was thought that English couldn't provide any kind of athletes. And the physics department had won that little intramural championship every year. We decisively upset and defeated the physics department and won the championship that year. One thing that helped us was that we had the captain of the previous Harvard team. Well, Harvard was not a Duke or North Carolina, but I guess he was a pretty good basketball player.
Uh-huh.
And we had also a fellow from North Carolina who was not on the North Carolina team, but he played a lot of basketball. And I played some class basketball. And we had a great triumph there. We defeated the physics department.
Oh, that must have been a big thing for you to remember these years, too.
So,
that must have been a lot of fun. Well, you've kept up with physical activities, obviously. You're a big tennis player.
We love tennis, and that was our... it was inexpensive. It cost practically nothing. We did that at Maine. Of course, you could not do it in the bad part of the year, which was a good part of the year. Except that we got a chance to play in the gym some Sunday mornings at 6 a.m. We'd go out to the gym on a wooden floor and play. But, I kept up with tennis.
And then when you moved out here, you could play year-round.
Yes, that's right. That's true.
Yeah. Well, since we're on the subject of sports, and we're really skipping around here as far as my questions go.
Put in any order you want. I mean, just rein me in if I'm wandering too much.
We're covering everything, but not in the order that I thought we were. Well, since we're on the subject of sports, I want to show you something. I made a photocopy of an item that I found in University Archives the other day as I was getting ready for this interview. And this is just a photocopy of something that was typed on State College letterhead. It must have been back in the 50s or 60s. And they put a date on there as 1984, possibly as looking to the future, as in the novel 1984 by Orwell. And it has to do with some professor's attitude towards football and the coaches and all the extra considerations that the football players received in class.
Oh, yeah, I see. It was a good little takeoff.
Have you ever seen
I never saw this.
You don't know the history of that or the background?
No.
Okay.
Do you know who wrote it?
No, I haven't the slightest idea.
Somebody who likes to do this kind of thing is Nelson Norman. retired history. He has other things right in line with us. I don't know whether he doesn't come to the the group of retired
group.
Professors at Anthony's every Tuesday, Jack and Kingsley from time to time.
Maybe what I will do is I will give a copy of this to Dr. Kenny and ask him to take it with him to the
luncheon
next week.
Yes, Luke could ask about
that. He could pass it around.
Oh, yeah, that would be
I bet
they'd
get a chuckle out of this.
Well, Jack Adams, did you ask Jack about that?
I haven't asked Dr. Adams.
Well, Jack may know. He may know about that.
Maybe he did it himself, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, that would be one way to track it down. It's good detective work. Yeah.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what, we're going to...
You go ahead with your questions, I'll just try to stay...
We're going
to
go back here a little bit. I'm going to ask you about your activities during World War II.
Okay.
What did you end up doing during the war?
I did a lot of things I never did before or after. I was lucky, I guess you'd say. Well, I considered lucky. I was turned down twice, once by the Navy when I could see the draft approaching, and I didn't see how my wife and three children could live off $25 a month, which was GI pay, I think, at that time. So I'd had some correspondence with the Navy, and they told me to come up to Richmond Market Armory in Baltimore, talk to me there. I got there, and they found that I had this ear mastoid when I was 5 years old. It never completely healed. And they said, well, we don't want you. But they said, don't worry. The Army will, if you breathe and are warm, the Army will take you. You don't have to worry. And Juanita did not think they would take me. She turned out to be right when a year later the draft did get around to me why they said no.
However,
what I was doing before that we were at Maine in Pearl Harbor. Was bombed on December the 7th, and I remember that very well. I was correcting freshman papers, and that first year at Maine, let's see, that was my first year, wasn't it, 41, it wasn't my first year, but anyhow, we had very heavy load there of composition. So I was, Sunday afternoon, I was correcting one paper after another. Anita had gone out to the little literary group, and department head, Milton Ellis, an American Lit scholar who did a good anthology and some good scholarship, was interested in writing. And so she was with that group when the news came over the radio. I didn't know about it. She came home. She said, have you heard the news? I said, what news? And
yeah, you've been sitting
that
there.
It was about 5 or 6 o'clock Sunday night. And so that was the beginning. I spent 1 year in the South during the war. Maine was mainly men, and so they were just going right out in a stream.
Right.
A friend of mine taught at a girls' college in the South, and nobody knew what was going to happen. I don't know about leaving the family here. We can't afford to keep the house if I do get drafted. What will I do? So I thought, he was leaving his place. He said, why don't you come down here? So I thought, well, it'll be warmer down there. So I went down there for a year. I wasn't too happy there, but anyhow, but some good things. I also did some machine shop work and math work at Maine. They offered those courses to faculty for some reason. Anyhow, when I went down there, I worked, not only did my teaching, but I found a small defense plant where I worked part-time.
Uh-huh.
And then at the end of the school year, which ended a little bit early, I was able to end it a little early, I worked full-time for maybe a month or so. And then Maine wanted me to come back and teach math. So, among other things, I ran a turret lathe. I was put in charge, and when I was working full-time for a short time in the defense plant, I was put in charge of an inspection department, and because those people that they had didn't have too much education. We made mistakes, we did precision work. We made aircraft parts for Glenn Martin, Curtis Wright, had a terrible reject rate. But the ones that got through, I guess, were good parts. They were done. The milling was done to the 100,000th of an inch.
Uh-huh. Well, and, better be accurate.
We were the one of the few places in that area that did this kind of work. So then they called me back to Maine to teach math, because I was glad to go because Juanita's health wasn't too good there. Our third child had been born down there. We had two children when the war broke out, and a third on the way. He was born down there, but kind of premature, not premature, but early, rather hard time for her.
Uh-huh.
So I was glad to come back to Maine, which we did. And although at that time, that was about the time also that I booked into the Navy, because I could see, I didn't know how much longer I'd be teaching or be in some service. And ironically, there did come a draft notice when I had just left and was going back to Maine. And I think what was happened was that the state of Maine was kind of short of manpower, and somebody who wasn't there, they were grabbing the ones who weren't in the state. I kind of, as I went to the president, I said, "Well, here I am, but I'll be here more than a couple of weeks. I'm supposed to." And he said, "Oh, you're all protected," he said. So the fact that I was teaching, but it was in the ASTP program. That was a nationwide Army specialized training program.
Uh-huh.
And I was teaching math. And one thing I was happy about,
yes,
was that, so I didn't have to worry about a draft then until they yanked them out. Then, of course, they grabbed me right away and they said, "Well, no, we don't want you." But the ASTP program, I was teaching analytic geometry. And another chap from English was, they had to get everybody they could. That was the big demand. And his class and my class and the weekly exams, we were always at the top. It had nothing to do with us. I did every problem in the book, but it had nothing to do with us. We had people from Yale, Princeton, Pittsburgh.
Huh.
We had a really elite group there. And it happened that he and I got